So the theme for the weekend is, of course, on caring and connection. And for this evening, I'm just going to keep it pretty broad and talk about caring and connection in general. And then hopefully the topics throughout the weekend will give us more specifics and hopefully some practical applications and practical things, what that actually means in our everyday lives, both at work and outside of work. So I have a couple stories to start with. There was once a man traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. On the way, he was attacked by robbers. They took his clothes, beat him up, and went off, leaving him half dead. Luckily, a priest was on his way down the same road. But when he saw him, he angled across to the other side. Then a Levite religious man showed up, but he also avoided the injured man. A Samaritan traveling the road came up to him. When he saw the man's condition, his heart went out to him. He gave him first aid, disinfecting and bandaging his wounds. Then he lifted him onto his donkey, led him to an inn, and made him comfortable. In the morning, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, "Take good care of him, and if it costs any more, put it on my bill. I'll pay you on the way back." Thank you. Hopefully a familiar story. The next one might not be. In 1764, if I remember my history correctly, that would have been during the French and Indian War, Colonel Henry Bouquet led an army from Fort Pitt, just west of here a little ways, into eastern Ohio in a campaign against the Shawnee, Delaware, and Seneca tribes. Once it became obvious that the Native American tribes would be slaughtered unless they surrendered, they negotiated terms of peace. One of the conditions of the peace treaty was that any captives living among the Indians, anybody that they had captured at any point, were to be freed. And there were 200 or 300 captives living with that group of tribes. And the condition of peace was that they would all be returned to their families. Now, obviously, this led to some joyous reunions. But the liberating army was shocked at the number of captives that were reluctant to leave the Native American tribes. Now, that might be understandable if it was, say, a young child that didn't remember the former life. All they remembered was growing up among Indians, and they didn't actually even realize that they had been captured as a very young child. But there were also numerous adult captives who were reluctant to return to their white families. Some reports from that time period actually indicate that a few of the freed captives snuck away from the army to rejoin the Native American tribes. And others were bound and forcibly returned to their homes among the settlers. Now, pieces of that story can be found lots of different places, probably in lots of history books. I first recall hearing about it, or at least hearing those details of it, from the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger. Anybody here read the book? Nobody. All right. I get to tell everybody about a new book, or new to you at least. So what do these stories have in common? And, of course, what do they have to do with this weekend? The story of the Good Samaritan, obviously, we're all familiar with, and that is a story that describes what true caring is really about. And I would argue it's the best example that we have of what Jesus calls our second most important thing in all of life, which is love your neighbor. First important, most important is love God. Second most important is love your neighbor. And this is the primary story, the primary example that Jesus gives of how to do that. The example of white settlers that were captured by Native Americans and then didn't really want to be freed is one of the starting points that Sebastian Younger uses in his book Tribe to argue that we as humans long for and are really made for, he doesn't believe in creation, so he argues for evolution, but the point is the same. He argues that we are made for connection, for community. And he does a really good job in this book of describing how, of describing the evidence that we as humans need connection. And he makes a really compelling argument for why society today has such an increase in mental and emotional health because of our lack of connection. Now, he goes on to argue in that, in his point about the Native American captives, that the main reason they wanted to stay was because of the connection within the tribe. Most Native American tribes lived a very connected life. You were very much a part of the tribe. You mattered. You were important to other people. Other people were important to you. And especially compared to what has, of course, become very common for all Americans, it seems like, our rugged individualism, compared to that, some people really felt at home in the Native American tribes, even if they were initially taken there by force. So, two main points I have for this evening to hopefully set the stage for the rest of the weekend. My first point is that we are designed for connection. And my second point is simply that we have a mandate to care for others. We are commanded to care. It's not optional. Genesis 2:18 says, "And the Lord God said, it's not good that man should be alone." Now, that's a pretty broad statement, and you could apply that verse lots of different ways, most likely. But I think it's an accurate statement, even in its most broad interpretation. Just simply, it's not good to be alone. And it's as simple as that. And you obviously don't need to look very far in literature to see that same theme come up over and over again. Whether it's a story about a child that's inadvertently left behind by their family, either for a short time or a long time, the lone survivor of some dreadful event, somebody stranded alone in a remote location, many writers throughout history have clearly tapped into that obvious fact that it is not a good thing to be alone. So we're created for connection. We're designed for connection. Lots of other scripture passages that highlight that as well, as well as some of the practical benefits of connectedness or of community. Matthew 18, 19, and 20. "Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them." So clearly, even in that context of us connecting to God in worship, there's something special about also doing that with other people. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 to 12, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? The one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken." And then Proverbs 27, 17, "As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend." So clearly, there's some obvious practical benefits of connecting with other people. It's actually good for me. It's not just good for the other people. It's also good for me. It's beneficial to for me if I am connected. So I'm going to look back at some more examples or arguments for connection from secular sources. I think it's fascinating. And at the same time, I'm challenged by the amount of attention that this topic is getting currently in secular circles. A few of the books or authors or topics that have really resonated with me are ones like the book The Anxious Generation, which is a fairly new book. There's a book that's been around a little bit longer called The Shallows, and they're focused primarily on the issue of social media and how the rise of social media actually decreases our connection. And both of those books actually make a pretty strong argument for social media being pretty directly tied to increases in depression, anxiety, emotional and mental instability. And I think that's fascinating, that there are people that are coming to this conclusion that we need each other, and they're coming to that conclusion from completely secular sources. I want to talk about a couple other points or examples from Sebastian Younger's book, Tribe. And I do actually recommend the book pretty highly. It's a fairly short book. It's, I would say, a fairly easy read. The subtitle of the book is On Homecoming and Belonging. And his main thesis in the book is really that we need connection. We need a tribe of people that we are connected to. Now, again, like I said, he does argue for a lot of his points, or he does explain a lot of his points from an evolution standpoint. But in my opinion, he's mostly reaching a conclusion and then trying to figure out how that conclusion reaches or fits in with evolution. The other big thing that I don't agree with in his book is, in my opinion, he tends to almost glorify war. He is primarily a war reporter who later in his career became a book writer and an author. He has experienced frontline reporting, news reporting, on battlefields in, I believe, the Bosnian War, the Iraq War, and the Afghanistan War, if I remember correctly. So a lot of his examples come from that sort of thing. And again, some of his points, I think, are valid, but I would argue he goes a little too far in the direction of almost pointing out the benefits of war and warfare. So one of the things he points out is a 2015 survey of lawyers that found that public defenders seem to be significantly happier than corporate lawyers. This was self-reported happiness. But the public defenders were significantly happier, despite the fact that in lawyer circles, at least, public defenders are pretty much at the bottom. Lowest paid, lowest prestige. Corporate lawyers are at the top. They get the biggest salaries. They have the most prestige. But they were at opposite ends of the happiness scale. And Sebastian Younger argues that that is likely because public defenders tend to be more connected to their clients, and they feel needed by their clients. Whereas the corporate lawyers, yeah, they're a lawyer for some big company rather than for a person, so there's not a connection there. And the companies are rich enough that, well, if I don't do a good job for them, they'll hire somebody else. Whereas a public defender might literally be the last line of defense for an individual. One of the most fascinating themes that comes through in Younger's book is how difficult times or tragedies, especially war, affect a group of people. He talks quite a bit about the bombing of London during World War II, the London Blitz, when the United States had not entered the war yet. England was kind of the last significant country that was fighting back against Germany. And the German Air Force started a campaign of bombing London, residential areas, in hopes of decreasing morale in the general public to the point where the British government would be forced to surrender. It was intentional bombing of residents, of civilians, in an attempt to intimidate and make everything worse. When this started, and if I remember my history correctly here again, I believe the German army made it very obvious what they were going to do ahead of time. They basically threatened, hey, if you don't surrender, this is what we're going to do. So the British knew it was coming. They just didn't have the defenses to do anything about it. They had basically no air force left and limited air defenses. There was really nothing they could do except just try to ride it out. The British government and the British hospital system very much expected and was trying to prepare for a massive increase in mental illness. One projection that was published was that they were expecting as many as 4 million people to need acute psychiatric care. However, as the Blitz campaign went on, and this lasted for 57 consecutive days. 57 consecutive days, every night, swarms of German bombers would bomb London. Every night, over and over and over again. As this went on, admissions to psychiatric hospitals decreased. Numerous doctors documented that individual patients with long-standing mental health conditions saw their symptoms improve. Active war was literally in their backyard. And the emotional and mental health of people didn't actually worsen. In fact, it seemed to get better. Now, ironically, after the United States joined the war, after the invasion of Normandy, we started pushing the Germans back. The Allied leadership decided they're going to do the same thing to try to force Germany to surrender. Huge bombing campaigns on civilians in German cities. For the same reason, in an attempt to decrease morale to the point where the German army is forced to surrender because the German civilian population no longer supports the war. And the Allied bombing campaign was much worse. In the city of Dresden, more people were killed in one night of bombing than in the entire war in London. So I guess the Allies thought that, well, the German strategy didn't work because they didn't do it long enough and hard enough, so we're going to do it even more. But ironically, the same thing happened. It backfired. German hospital systems, German physicians, made the same reports that their British counterparts had made during the bombing of London. Fewer people reported psychiatric problems. People with existing psychiatric problems reported fewer symptoms. Why is that? What's going on there? And what does that have to do with community specifically? Now, others who have studied this have said similar things, but Sebastian Younger in this book argues that disasters in general, but especially disasters that are indiscriminate in who they affect, usually tend to create a community of sufferers. And then he argues that that community is simply so beneficial that it outweighs the negative effects of the actual war. That's, again, literally in their backyard. Difficult times tend to have a way of putting everybody in the same boat. And that is usually going to lead to us being more connected. In addition, difficult times, we're more likely to be forced to rely on our neighbors for help, and vice versa. So these sorts of examples, again, he argues that this proves, or at least is an example of the fact that we humans crave connection, and even more than that, we really need connection to function well. And then again, from there, he makes the point, like I mentioned earlier, that one of the huge problems with society today is we are not connected enough. There's other Bible stories that we could look at that point out the same thing, that point out how we crave connection despite hardship. There are numerous times where it's pretty obvious that you've got two choices in front of you, or the people in the story, in the Bible story even, had two choices in front of them. This way was going to be easier, but there's less connection. And people usually choose connectedness. Ruth and Naomi, they chose to stay together despite the fact that, like, leaving your homeland, leaving everybody else you know, going to this strange country just because you have a close connection with this one person. David and Jonathan. Bible says that, and I don't remember which one was saying this about the other, but I think it was very mutual. He loved him as he loved himself. It's pretty obvious that they were best of friends, despite the awkward fact, if I'm David, that, hey, you're my best friend, but also your dad keeps trying to kill me. Wouldn't have it been easy for them to just go their separate ways? Apparently not. Another example of the power of connection, I think, is simply storytelling. Why is storytelling so powerful? Why did Jesus repeatedly use storytelling as a means of communication? I think a big part of it is that if I tell a story, there's a lot more of a connection than if I just give you some information, or if I just give you commands, even from a leadership standpoint, but especially from more of a teacher standpoint. I can just give you all the facts, or I can tell you a story, and one clearly works better than the other. And I think it's partly, maybe mostly, because stories have a way of building connection. They build connection between the listener and the storyteller, but they also build connection between both of us and that person that's in the story, even if that person is completely fictional. Moving on to my second point, that we have a mandate to care. This is, in my opinion, much more straightforward. And we could probably just read the story of the Good Samaritan and pretty much stop there. I'll say a few more things about it, though. If you look at the story of the Good Samaritan, I think it's interesting that Jesus never directly answers the lawyer's question. So the lawyer asked Jesus, of course, who's my neighbor? Now, first of all, the lawyer came to Jesus and said, what's the most important thing to do? Jesus said, love God, love your neighbor. Okay, well, who's my neighbor? Typical lawyer fashion, always digging deeper into more and more specific questions. And I don't know whether it was malicious or not, but it seems that he was very much thinking like a lawyer, and he was trying to be logical. Okay, I'm supposed to love my neighbor. Who is my neighbor? Now, maybe he was also kind of looking for the minimum requirement. Like, okay, who's my neighbor? And indirectly asking who is not my neighbor, so I don't need to bother loving them. Whatever his intent was, whether he was somewhat malicious with his questions or not, he was clearly approaching it from the standpoint that I need to identify my neighbor so that I know who I'm required to love. In typical fashion, Jesus just flips it completely around. And in the story of the Good Samaritan, he makes it obvious that the neighbor is simply the person who cared. So Jesus is teaching, his answer to the question, who's your neighbor, is simply that if you find somebody to love, that person has now become your neighbor. So instead of find out who my neighbor is so that I can love them, it's find someone I can love and they become my neighbor. It's an approach from the opposite side. Instead of who I need to love being a function of who my neighbor is, in math terms, who my neighbor is becomes a function of who I'm able to love. Numerous other scriptures commanding us to care for others. And of course, many examples of how Jesus cared for those around him. In particular, we are commanded to care for the least of these. Care for those who are most unlike us. Care for those who are least capable of repaying us. So what is it like for us to care for others as Christians in healthcare, specifically as Anabaptists in healthcare? So maybe changing the topic a little bit, but I would say that there are aspects of life as an Anabaptist healthcare worker that I've occasionally described it to other people as feeling a little bit like having one foot each in two completely different worlds. There's a little bit of that. But I don't think that's a complete picture. At least I have not found it to be that way entirely. Specifically, some people seem to have the opinion that it is a huge contradiction, or at the very least a potential problem, a potential contradiction, because surely my beliefs and values as a Christian, especially my beliefs and values as an Anabaptist, contradict or conflict a little bit with the beliefs and values of the healthcare system, or at least of other people that work in healthcare. And again, there's probably some truth to that if you actually have that conversation with somebody. But what I have become more and more convinced of, and what I have begun telling people more and more, is that I firmly believe that my beliefs and values as a Christian, and specifically my beliefs and values as an Anabaptist, are actually a perfect fit for healthcare. As Christians, we believe we're all made in God's image. I'm no better than anybody else. We believe we're commanded to love God and then love people. That's the two most important things we can do. As Anabaptists specifically, we have a long heritage of loving people in practical ways, in physical ways. Loving people, caring for people, needs to include physical action and probably is going to include physical sacrifice. Humility, patience, long-suffering, kindness, gentleness, meekness, etc., are all characteristics that should be evident in my daily life. They're not just theoretical ideas or ideals. They should be evident. And again, I truly believe all of those beliefs, all of those values are important and helpful, and I would say pretty much necessary in learning how to deal with people as a nurse. One of the things that over the last couple years I've found a little ironic at times is one specific class or presentation at the hospital that I've had the opportunity of sitting in multiple times. I specifically work in nursing education. And one of my roles is teaching a lot of the classes that we have for our new critical care nurses in our critical care nurse fellowship program. One of the sessions that I teach, we have about an hour in the afternoon where we have a presenter come in to do a presentation on verbal judo. Anybody know anything about verbal judo? It's actually really good. The person who came up with this, who published the book on it, has kind of the, I guess it's the subtitle of the book, but also kind of the explanation of his idea of verbal judo as the gentle art of persuasion. And the guy that we have coming in to present this to our new ICU nurses is a nurse educator, of course, but he's got a background in law enforcement and in military, and he is currently our hospital system's nurse security liaison. So he teaches a lot of classes for security, he teaches a lot of classes for the nursing staff, And he very much lives between those two worlds. And he's, of course, a fairly big, burly guy and very loud. And you can probably come up with a pretty accurate picture of him. What I find fascinating and a little ironic is that when I sit in this session listening to him speak, and I've heard him give his presentation probably 5 or 6 times at least in the last few years, I can't help but thinking over and over again that that point that he's making about how you need to learn to deal with others, about how you need to not be offended at the way they're treating you because they're having the worst day of their lives, about how you need to approach them gently and with meekness. And like, he really could give the exact same information, give the exact same presentation, and just use a different term, and he would be describing all the fruits of the Spirit. And I could kind of do the opposite. I could probably take his presentation and give it at a Bible study and switch out a few words so that it's on the fruits of the Spirit. There's a pretty close overlap there. So again, I think I understand where people are coming from when they talk about or are concerned about possible conflict or contradictions between working in healthcare and being a Christian, specifically being a Mennonite or an Anabaptist. I think I do understand where they're coming from. And I won't say I disagree with them entirely, but I do disagree with them quite a bit. I do think it is actually a good fit for my beliefs, for my values. To start kind of wrapping this up, I have a quote, or speech maybe, from Menno Simons. Hopefully you've heard this before, or at least part of it. True evangelical faith is of such a nature, it cannot lie dormant, but spreads itself out in all kinds of righteousness and fruits of love. It dies to flesh and blood. It destroys all lusts and forbidden desires. It seeks, serves, and fears God in its inmost soul. It clothes the naked. It feeds the hungry. It comforts the sorrowful. It shelters the destitute. It aids and consoles the sad. It does good to those who do it harm. It serves those that harm it. It prays for those who persecute it. It teaches, admonishes, and judges us with the word of the Lord. It seeks those who are lost. It binds up what is wounded. It heals the sick. It saves what is strong or sound. It becomes all things to all people. The persecution, suffering, and anguish that come to it for the sake of the Lord's truth have become a glorious joy and comfort to it. In the almost 15 years that I've worked in healthcare, I think I've done a fair amount of healing, or at least helping to heal. I've bound up what is wounded. I've done good to those who wish to harm me. I've aided and consoled the sad. I've comforted the sorrowful. I've fed the hungry. And of course, since I work in the ICU, I've also clothed the naked. And I've got to say, I've done a whole lot more of that in the hospital than I have in the church. So again, that is my argument that working in healthcare is a fit for my beliefs and values. It is acting out, if we're doing it well at least, it is acting out both that connection that we are created for and that caring that we are commanded to do. True evangelical faith cannot lie sleeping. So, as you work in healthcare, as you go through life, no matter where you are, embrace that connection with others. It really is what we were created for. It is how we function best when we are connected. And find people to care for. It's what we're commanded to do.